Hello. It would seem that the Virgin Mary has been making frequent return visits to planet Earth. There were relatively few sightings of her before the middle of the 18th century, but since then she's been seen at Lourdes in southwest France, Fatima in Portugal, Knock in northwest Ireland, and in other places far too numerous to mention. The Vatican has given its seal of approval to only a few such apparitions. At present, it's deliberating whether to give the thumbs up to sightings in Medjugorje in Bosnia and Herzegovina. These began in 1981 and continue right to the present day. So what exactly are Marian apparitions? How are they to be explained? Do they have common features? And why have they become so common in this supposedly secular age? Joining me to discuss the phenomenon of apparitions are John Thavis, a veteran Vatican journalist and author of The Vatican Prophecies, Investigating Signs, Apparitions and Miracles in the Modern Age. Dr. Chris Maunder, Senior Lecturer in Theology at York St. John University and author of Our Lady of the Nations, Apparitions of Mary in 20th Century Catholic Europe. And Dr. Sarah Boss, Director of the Centre for Marian Studies, the University of Roehampton. Chris, define what you mean by an apparition.
Well, an apparition is when somebody claims to see a figure which appears real, but they know that it's not real in the sort of 3D sense of the word. So something happens that perhaps the figure hovers, it appears and disappears, it's surrounded by rays of light. So there's some clues to the fact that this is not an ordinary person.
Have you anything to add to that, Sarah?
Before the modern period, before the kind of ones that we're mainly interested in today, people often didn't really distinguish between waking visions and dreams. You know, modern people think the fact of a waking vision is a really kind of interesting thing in itself. Whereas in ancient and medieval accounts, often they don't bother to specify whether the apparition occurred in a dream or awake, because they were really interested in what did it mean, not this kind of phenomenal aspect.
John, you're a hard-nosed journalist. What do you make of apparitions?
Right. Well, of course, skepticism is part of journalism, and there is scientific skepticism about any claim of apparition. I think most Catholic experts would make the point that we are talking here about what they would call a miraculous perception, not the actual physical presence of Mary or another being. The idea is that through a special grace, Mary takes a form that is observed or sensed. It can be auditory, it doesn't have to be. It's often unexpected. It's often to people who are not really striving in a religious way or in a contemplative way. People who are simple and humble, people who never were expecting this to happen.
How far back in history do apparitions of Mary go, Chris?
Well, Zaragoza in Spain claims to have the first one back in the year 40, but I think we might be sceptical of the date. But certainly, I think from the 4th century, you can say that apparitions of Mary were reported.
And John, they are a fairly recent phenomenon, nevertheless.
Well, they do go back in history. The difference is that in medieval times, for example, these were generally local phenomena, and so were not highly publicized. Most didn't even come to the attention, for example, of church authorities in Rome. What we had in the 18th and 19th centuries was a kind of rediscovery and an internationalization of the popularity of Marian apparitions, along with international pilgrimages. And so in France, you had a number of very important apparitions in the 1800s that were approved right up to the level of the Vatican. And that really kind of ignited a movement of Marian appearances.
The most famous place where she gave God's word to the world, Sarah, was Lourdes. And I'd like you to tell me very briefly what happened at Lourdes.
Yeah, in 1858, in this medium-sized town in the French Pyrenees, Lourdes, a young girl, 13-year-old girl called Bernadette Soubirous, had a sequence of visions, apparitions of a female figure in a grotto above the river there. The vision told her, she said, "I am the Immaculate Conception." Now, this was 4 years after the Pope, Pius IX, had proclaimed the dogma of the Immaculate Conception, which says the Blessed Virgin Mary was conceived without original sin. So Mary was, as it were, identifying herself, associating herself with that teaching in this vision. And then she told Bernadette to dig with her hands in the mud, and Bernadette found a spring there, which turned out to have healing properties. And eventually, the apparitions were seen as worthy of belief by church authorities, and an enormous shrine developed there where people go especially for healing, but also for obviously for spiritual refreshment and so on.
And the second most well-known one, I think, John, is probably Fatima. Tell me what happened there.
Right. Well, at Fatima, we're in the year 1917. Of course, World War I is raging throughout Europe. But we had three young children who were tending sheep outside of town, and they saw a flash like lightning in the sky and looked up to see what they said was a lady clothed in white. Eventually, this lady told them she had come from heaven, and she asked the youngsters to sacrifice, suffer for the conversion of sinners. She promised that she would appear again on the 13th of each month for the next 6 months. Well, as you can imagine, word quickly spread locally. There actually was much derision, more than interest at first, but about 50 people showed up in June, a month later. And with each apparition, the crowds grew. Finally, on October 13th, there were tens of thousands of people who witnessed what they said was the miracle of the sun. They saw the sun bounce around the sky, according to witnesses, and this was a sign that Mary had promised the children.
Chris, there must be a natural explanation to the sun spinning.
Well, if there is one, I don't think it's been established exactly what did happen on that day. Some people have tried to talk about an atmospheric phenomenon. I think what is interesting is that the children did predict a miracle in advance. So if there was an unusual atmospheric phenomenon, it was in itself a miracle that it should happen at that particular day and an hour.
They do have common features, though, John. They're usually given to children. They're usually poor children living in marginalised communities.
Exactly. History of apparitions has been to people who are not all that educated, not very sophisticated. And actually, if you talk to experts at the Vatican, they say this often counts in their favour, in the favour of authenticity. The more ignorant, in some senses, the least sophisticated of the visionaries have turned out to be the most authentic ones.
Sarah?
But John, is it not the case that although most of the approved apparitions are to people who are, you know, very young or poor or both, that the number of people who actually claim to have apparitions of Mary does include a much, much larger number of people who are older, better educated, male, and so on. And it's really the church's system of approving them which filters it down in this way.
Yes, Sarah, I think you're right. But one of the problems I encountered when I researched my book was that there are no central statistics on anything like this, at least in the Catholic Church. You know, the Vatican does not have a department of the supernatural. It doesn't track. It doesn't have an official list of Marian apparitions. Mm-hmm. In fact, if you ask at the Vatican how many approved Marian apparitions are there, you're going to get a different answer from everyone because there is no official list. Marian apparitions can be approved at the Vatican, as about a dozen have. They can be approved by tradition, about 20 more. They can be approved by the local bishop, which happened in the United States about 6 years ago. He didn't ask for or need Vatican approval.
There are, in fact, hundreds of local ones around the world.
Exactly.
Well, Chris, tell the story of the most recent one, or at least one of the most recent ones, and perhaps the most controversial one, the one at Medjugorje.
Yes, Medjugorje started on the 24th of June 1981, so it's in recent history. The visionaries are all still alive. Two girls, first of all, saw a figure that they identified as being the Gospa, which is Our Lady in Croatian, and they summoned other teenagers around them so that eventually, after 24 hours, a group of six was formed. Then this group of six then saw the Madonna on regular occasions. There were many crowds, I think, that gathered at an early point, but after about a week, the parish priest, who was a Franciscan, decided that he wanted to take control of the situation and invited the visionaries to come from the hillside into the parish church. And so from that point on, the apparitions were more controlled, more structured, and happening at a particular time of day and in the parish church. The real problem started when the bishop decided that the apparitions were being used by the Franciscans against his authority. That's a long story, but ultimately the bishop became very much opponent of Medjugorje.
John, there was a rather unfortunate connection in the Balkan War with Croatian nationalism, which sort of brought Medjugorje into disrepute.
Of course, there was tremendous suffering among the people. There was fighting that was very deadly between the ethnic groups there. And, you know, many of the pilgrims who went there said they were a little surprised to see that Mary's daily messages were not really addressing the war. In fact, sometimes they seemed oddly disconnected with the fighting that was going on around them. She at one point called Medjugorje an oasis of peace, and it was almost as if this is a bubble and we don't have to pay attention to the suffering going on outside of this bubble.
And Sarah, the Vatican is supposedly looking at Medjugorje to see whether it should approve it officially. What will their criteria be when deciding that?
They have a long list of criteria, which are really based on a list drawn up in the 18th century for determining apparitions. So they include a number of things. I mean, one is the character of the visionary or visionaries. Are they reliable, trustworthy? Another is what are the spiritual fruits? So do the visionaries themselves and the people who show an interest in and belief in the visions, do they lead better lives afterwards? Are they better Christians as a result of this? Another consideration is whether there could be a natural, a medical or scientific explanation for the phenomena. And this tends to be the criterion that is given highest weight by commissions of inquiry set up by the local bishop. And I think really we need to kind of move beyond the sort of criteria that are dominating commissions at the moment and say, ask much more, what are the spiritual fruits of these apparitions, rather than asking these, what I think are rather dull technical questions.
John, there is one major problem which distinguishes Medjugorje from both Lourdes and Fatima. The messages go on. The visionaries are still alive. And if the Vatican approves it, the situation could arise that in 10 years' time they would say something with which the Vatican thoroughly disapproves, and that could lead to real problems.
Right. This is the great fear of Vatican officials who have convened an international commission. I think, as you know, the commission worked for 4 years. It handed in their homework more than a year ago. And so Pope Francis is kind of sitting on it right now, supposedly preparing to issue some kind of a verdict. But I was told that some of the commission members actually stopped coming to meetings fairly early because they said there is simply no way we can issue a judgment on apparitions that are ongoing. And as one Vatican official put it to me, we can say today, yes, this is of supernatural origin, and then tomorrow, what if Mary spouts some heresy? You know, we are in trouble.
And the visionaries, John, are traveling around the world, so they're spreading the message all over the place.
There was a sense that Mary was being stage managed by the Franciscan friars at Medjugorje. And this concern has continued as some of the visionaries have gone on to world tours, really. They take their apparitions with them, and the apparition of Mary is part of their appearance at any given city at any given time.
Well, let me remind you that you're listening to Beyond Belief, and today we're discussing apparitions of the Virgin Mary. Why are they on the increase in what is supposed to be an increasingly secular age? Do they run the risk of exploiting the vulnerable, such as sick people who come looking for healing? And with me are Sarah Boss, Chris Maunder and John Thavis. Dr. Michael Moran is a clinical lecturer at University College London, where he specialises in ear, nose, throat, head and neck surgery. He travels to the Marian Shrine at Lourdes every year, and has recently become the first Irish person to be appointed to the committee of 34 medical doctors from 10 different countries who are tasked with evaluating claims of miraculous cures at Lourdes.
The translation of what happened at Lourdes is, I think, the most important aspect in that it has become a place of sanctuary for the sick. You know, you're immediately struck by, first of all, the amount of sick people that are there, but also the amount of volunteers that there are there to help them. And the sick are really prioritised, and it sort of makes you realise, you know, how disabled, unfriendly the real world is. You know, when you see it's really all geared up to them there. And I think it's a sort of a human outcome from a divine event.
You've got an official role. For the last number of years, you've been going as the chief medical officer for the Down and Connor Diocese, and you've been caring for up to 600 people. Is there one experience that somebody has told you about that sticks in your memory?
gentleman with advanced pancreatic cancer who'd really become quite ill, having been very fit and well, you know, found that he got a real uplift from Lourdes, and his wife afterwards would have said to me that, you know, his energy levels really picked up. He was able to get to do things that he hadn't been able to do for a while. And you see these sorts of things where people just get a real boost. It doesn't necessarily rid them of an illness, but it gives them somehow even the strength to face what lies ahead, be that a terminal illness or, you know, ongoing disability. And from a personal perspective, I think it's those sort of small things and the minor miracles that, you know, no board of doctors are ever going to sit down and discuss are really sort of what gives Lourdes a real rich sort of spiritual and, you know, personal aspect to it.
Healing clearly means different things to different mm-hmm. people. And I'm just wondering, what turns a healing into a miracle?
The church. So, you know, as doctors, we would look entirely at the medical evidence, whether we can find a medical explanation for a cure. And beyond that, then the patient or the pilgrim goes back to their home context, contacts their own bishop, and then it's the church that will decide on whether there is a miraculous status to be applied to what has happened. So we would talk about inexplicable cures and the church might talk about miracles. So as a body of doctors, although we have a bishop on our panel, we don't liaise directly with the church, essentially.
So you're there to act as sort of devil's advocate, yeah, to try to find reasons why it might not be a miracle.
Exactly, exactly. And it's a common misconception because a lot of people think, you know, we're pro-miracle. And in a sense, you know, first of all, we don't solicit any business. We don't try to bring people in. But we very much are quite a negative committee in our outlook. And I'm sure for some people who bring their cases forward, that can be deemed to be quite a pessimistic outlook given the context in which we work. But I think it's really important that there is some scientific rigour applied.
So in your terms, what is a cure?
From the International Medical Committee perspective, we are very specific in that it has to be an absence of illness that has to be, you know, demonstrated with scans or biopsies and things like that. And often the patient or pilgrim concerned has to go through a lot of extra medical tests to demonstrate that. One case springs to mind recently that didn't meet the criteria was a man who was quite severely disabled, who became suddenly better and so physically was much better and considered to be totally cured. But when brain scans were reviewed, there was still a lesion present that hadn't completely gone away. And because that was there, it couldn't be passed as an inexplicable cure, although the gentleman concerned feels completely better and is physically better.
There haven't been many, it's got to be said. I think only 69 since the actual apparition occurred. But as a doctor, you are expected to be governed by reason.
Yeah.
Do you believe that there have been real, genuine miracles?
The bottom line is that you can't explain it in any other way. And the records are available to interrogate. I've seen enough to have been impressed, but I'd say that probably the more the personal experiences, the smaller things in terms of medical evidence are sometimes the more impressive things that you see, you know, emotional changes, spiritual changes, which, you know, is hard to tangibly explain.
That was Dr. Michael Moran. Sarah, what did you make of that?
I am rather concerned about determining whether a miracle has happened by, you know, going through all the scientific evidence in that way, because after all, the more scientific knowledge is acquired about, you know, the human brain, the human body, the less room there is for scientists, for doctors not to be able to find a medical explanation for an apparent cure. And I think that I suppose what I want to focus on is the fact that regardless of what the doctors say, people actually feel better and undergo a transformation of their whole quality of life.
Chris?
Yes, and I've heard cases where people claim that just acceptance of some illness that can't be cured is in itself a kind of transformation and a healing. So I remember hearing the story of the rugby player who had a broken neck and was therefore paralysed. And going to Lourdes helped him just come to terms with his situation. He wasn't physically healed, but he was, if you like, spiritually helped in his sort of life journey.
You know, it reminds me of an interview I did. I interviewed a Jesuit professor of spirituality who had been to Lourdes. And he was always a little skeptical about Lourdes because he was always wondering, how can children who suffer brain disabilities, how can they be left to suffer? This was a question that had bothered him his entire career. This man was a Jesuit priest and a psychologist. And so he went to Lourdes, and he was watching the old people kind of bathe in the waters and come out when he saw a young girl who was obviously very disabled, kind of foaming at the mouth, he said, and thrashing about. And he said to himself, why can't she get a miracle? And at that moment, he said he saw the girl's mother come over, gently hug her, pick her up, and take her away. And this priest told me, he said, at that moment, I knew. He said, that was my answer. There are miracles, and there are miracles. He could not stand to see this young girl for even a minute, but here was her mother who would love her her entire life. And, you know, that's the kind of insight I think that some people receive at Lourdes, which might not happen otherwise.
Do you think that Lourdes is different in that sense, in that it is a caring place? Everything is centred on the needs of those who come there. And there's a risk that there could be an unhealthy obsession with the supernatural and the superstitious, which may be a factor in other shrines.
Well, I think that at other shrines there isn't quite the same emphasis on disability and helping the sick and so on, but that it is still part of the story of other shrines. So when you go there, you will see people in wheelchairs. Traditionally, you see people leave their crutches at the shrines because they've been healed, and they leave the crutch as a sign of healing. So that is still a feature of other shrines. It's not absent from those.
I sense that Lourdes is Francis' sort of place, John. But Medjugorje may not be. What do you think his personal attitude is likely to be to what's gone on at Medjugorje?
Pope Francis has actually made that pretty clear to perhaps the concern of some devotees of Medjugorje. He warned that people should not be out searching for supernatural signs, or people should not believe that Mary appears to them every afternoon and sends off messages at 4 o'clock like a postmaster. And, you know, those words stung really at Medjugorje, because, of course, they do believe that Mary is sending them a new message every day. The Pope has gone on other occasions to say that people who hunt for supernatural signs are on the wrong path. That's not where Christianity is lived. He sees a real danger in Catholics who obsess over this, kind of hunt for a sign from Mary or from anyone else.
Is there a psychological or a sociological reason for it?
Well, you would probably get different answers from different experts. I tend to think that we live in an age that is rather dominated by scientific explanations of everything. And I think many people, including Christians, Catholics, aren't completely satisfied with scientific explanations of things. They're looking for something that speaks to them more directly.
Sarah?
I think that's very interesting. I think we live in a society in which spiritual practices are excluded from the public domain. Normally, we live in a secular environment. Spiritual experiences seem as exceptional. And so I think a lot of us really lack spiritual maturity. It's as though our spiritual development is kind of etiolated. It's got shut away. And it's almost, that people are craving, they have such a hunger for spiritual fulfilment, for spiritual understanding, that when it does seem to be appearing somewhere, people, not surprisingly, just want to say, yes, I want to go there and get it. And the task, I think, for us is to learn to live in a way in which our spiritual lives are really fully integrated into our daily lives, so that we have a proper perspective on these things.
But Chris, it's got to be said that Medjugorje divides Catholics. The Bishop of Mostar, who I think is the bishop of the local diocese, has gone as far as to say that he thinks the visionaries are fakes.
Yes, and that is one of the negative criteria. So if the Catholics are strongly divided, that doesn't help the cause of an apparition. I agree with you. I think, though, that shrines do outlive the problems of their origin. There's been battles between nationalists, for example, or royalists and republicans and so on have been features of the histories of shrines. And so it might be that Medjugorje outlives those problems to be a shrine, and that people sort of forget the difficulty with the Croatian nationalism or some of the problems with the Franciscans and the bishop. So I think time will tell. But the strength of support for Medjugorje is massive. And I think in the light of that, it's very difficult to overlook it. It's certainly not possible to suppress it.
John, is there a difficult balancing act that the Vatican has to carry out in its dealings with Medjugorje, in the sense that it doesn't want to disillusion the faithful, but it doesn't want to give approval?
Right. I've written about Medjugorje as a kind of worst-case management scenario for the Vatican, because, you know, the Vatican's policy on apparitions for centuries has pretty much been, let it play out. Let's not talk about it. Well, you know, that may have worked in some places, but not in Medjugorje, because these apparitions have allegedly been going on now for 35 years. And so, you know, Catholics have, and others have voted with their feet. They have, millions and millions of people have gone to Medjugorje. And at this point, for the Vatican to come in with a commission and issue a verdict that says, no, we don't think anything supernatural is happening here, would greatly disappoint and disillusion many people. And they are in a tough place. If you talk with Vatican officials, you will find immediate concerns about the idea that there are issues of disobedience here. The Franciscan friars who disobeyed the local bishop, Mary who supposedly sided with the friars against the bishop. As one official at the Vatican told me, we can't expect Mary to have a degree in canon law, but she should at least know the rules of the church. So I agree, they're in a tough position, and I think that's one reason why there's been a delay in issuing the Vatican verdict here. Pope Francis said last June it would come soon. Of course, soon in Vatican speak can mean many, many things.
So let me ask each one of you a final question. I'll come to you first, Sarah. What do you think the Vatican will do about Medjugorje?
I think that the best thing would be if it just suspended judgment on the apparitions and recognised that the shrine itself has a cult of Our Lady that should be supported and is a legitimate devotion for ordinary Catholics.
Chris?
I think that the Church, I don't think, can approve the apparitions, but it can accept the shrine as a place of pilgrimage and devotion. There have been many other cases where this has happened, particularly in Germany, for example, where diocesan shrines have been accepted, but the apparitions have not.
John?
Right, here's my prediction. I think the Vatican will avoid an up or down judgment on the supernatural nature of these apparitions. I think what they will do is remove the visionaries from circulation, from direct contact with pilgrims. I think they may well remove the sanctuary from the oversight of the local bishop and the local Franciscan friars. I think they want to remove the elements of conflict from this and perhaps put it under some kind of international auspices.
How could they do that, John? How could they remove the visionaries?
Well, they can't remove the visionaries, but they could make some rules and say, you know, we are asking you to avoid speaking directly about the apparitions as if they were real. And that's already been a bone of contention. They have already, with one of the visionaries, asked him not to go on tour and, in a sense, perform the apparition. I think what's going on in Medjugorje now, where you have at least two visionaries meeting regularly with pilgrims, I expect the Vatican will at least discourage that.
Well, that's all for this week and for this series. My thanks to Chris Maunder, Sarah Boss and John Thavis. I'll be back for another series of Beyond Belief later in the year.